Welcome to The Current, a podcast produced by We Stand for Energy. We Stand for Energy is a community that supports a reliable, affordable, and sustainable energy future for everyone. It is a project of EEI, Edison Electric Institute, the National Trade Association representing U.S. investor-owned electric companies. My name is Brad Viator, Executive Director of External Affairs at EEI, and I'm your host. Welcome back, everyone. Today, I have the pleasure of being joined by Dr. Lawrence Jones, the Vice President of International Programs at the Edison Electric Institute. And Lawrence is going to tell me a little bit about what's going on in the time of COVID all around the world in the electric sector. But before we do that, Lawrence, can you just give the audience a little bit of a background on the role of the International Department at EEI?
Well, thank you, Brad, and thanks for inviting me to be part of this current podcast. The international program at EEI was established about 25 years ago, primarily with the goal of creating opportunities for U.S. and international organizations, utilities primarily, to work together, share best practices, also to create market opportunities for U.S. electric companies at the time who were looking to expand outside of the U.S., but also for international companies who are looking to expand in the U.S. And so to date, we have about 75 international electric companies who are members of EEI's national program, and they all have operations in about 90 countries. So we have a pretty broad international footprint. What we do is similar to what the domestic program does, but somewhat constrained in the sense that we do not do any sort of a big public policy advocacy across the globe, but we do get involved in a lot of knowledge sharing. We do get involved in a lot of technical sharing of ideas. We also look at innovation. So some of the same issues facing the U.S. companies are the same issues facing international companies. So we create that bridge for knowledge sharing, but also we also get more involved in the issue of regulatory and policy, where we try to identify policies in the U.S. that might be applicable to other parts of the world and vice versa.
Excellent. Thank you. Well, let's get into the COVID discussion a little bit. I know one particular area where there are pretty substantial differences between what's going on in the rest of the world versus what's going on in the United States is in and around reentry and kind of reentry policies in other parts of the world. You know, what are you seeing from other countries that have sort of lifted their lockdowns and started reentry?
So what has been very interesting is that the lockdown across the world have been almost regional in terms of how it's being adapted. So starting off from Asia, where things sort of moved west, you had very stringent lockdowns in Korea, also in New Zealand, Australia. You also had similar lockdowns that sort of was going on obviously in China. And then you moved to Europe, where you had Italy taking the lead on lockdowns, and then eventually it started moving towards the U.S. in terms of lockdowns. What has happened, Brad, is that many countries that locked down early discovered that they, in many cases, removed the lockdown even earlier than they should have. And so you've seen in parts of Asia and in Europe a so-called second wave occurring, where the re-entry processes that they put in place for utilities or for electric companies, as well as for other industries, have now have to be revisited. So, for example, in Belgium, they had to sort of institute a mini shutdown, if you may. In New Zealand, which is now seen as the model for doing effective shutdown, they recently, as last week, had some clusters that had erupted in Auckland. And so they've had to start to do regional lockdowns within the country, where you don't lock down the entire country, you lock down parts of the country. I think in terms of the comparison, I would say that in terms of the U.S., I think a lot of people have looked at from abroad, have looked at the New York model, they've looked at other models in different states. I think reentry is going to be a challenge with the second wave coming. We had a conversation last night with folks in Hong Kong and Australia, where they are already seeing a second wave. In fact, in Hong Kong, they're even talking about a third wave because they were ahead of the pack in terms of the first and second wave. So I think by and large, across the globe, lockdowns are being sort of eased in some countries. I should also mention another region that's very interesting to observe is the Middle East, specifically in Bahrain, Dubai, where they now have reached a stage where they have not just eased down the lockdown, where they've also decided now that you do not have to quarantine yourself for 14 days if you move, come into the country, which is something you had to do before. So I think a lot of similarities to the U.S. in terms of prioritizing lockdowns, but I think the difference is the extent to which they have eased some of these restrictions that we've seen being put in place across the globe.
All right, let's dig into what impact this has had on electricity across the world. What's been happening with electricity demand with your members?
So if we go back to January, February timeframe, in fact, I think perhaps March, that's when you started to see real decline in demand. You saw significant decline in demand as these lockdowns were put in place. Now, over time, what has happened because of the variation in weather, some countries have seen an increase in demand. Others still see a drop in demand. Across the globe, we had about 5% drop in demand globally for electricity. That is changing. Some countries had as high as 20% drop in demand, but it all depends on the mix of your customers. So if you take, for example, companies in Canada that have a very strong oil-dependent industry, they've seen a significant drop because of the price of oil dropping. Those companies have seen significant drop in the demand for electricity. On the other hand, we've seen in the Gulf states where they've had extreme temperature, combined that with the fact that more people are staying home, they've, on the other hand, seen significant increase in residential demand in the Gulf state because of the temperature differences there. But then also, if you take a place like, say, Europe, specifically if you look at the cooler Scandinavian countries, they've seen a kind of a, I would call it, moderate drop in demand because their summers actually have gotten warmer. And so you see this thing where weather is really determining the extent to which drop in demand is occurring. Now, the IEA predicts that, the International Energy Agency predicts that by the end of the year, once you start seeing sort of maybe there's a vaccine in place and people start going back to normal, you will see an increase.
It's kind of a similar story in the U.S. We were having a conversation on an earlier podcast about electricity demand all across the country. And the thing that we were seeing was slight uptick in residential demand, a bit of a downtick on the commercial side of the equation. But the way that one person described it is that every day is now looking like a very busy weekend day on the residential side of the equation. So it's leading to changes, I think, in how the energy grid's being stretched right now. And I would assume that there are similar challenges elsewhere in the world on that front as well.
Yeah, one point I would interject in terms of demand, and we're seeing that in New Zealand and elsewhere, is that the demand for data storage is one source of demand that a lot of electric companies didn't see coming. And so now you have this huge demand for data storage across the globe.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Interesting point to think about. All right, so let's try to take a step back, right? Like, it's hard for us to take a step back while we're in the middle of this mess. What are some of the adjustments to the global electric business that you're seeing, start to take place in real time that you think will have like a lasting impact?
Yeah, so the three that come to mind. So the first one has to do with workforce modification. And but what I mean by that is the call we had this morning with a number of our members in Canada and Europe, basically they are redesigning work as we speak. Give you one example. They don't expect, some of them, 40% of their workforce will not return to the office even after the pandemic, simply because they've seen a lot of efficiencies in terms of not having these people commute long distances to come to the offices. And so one specific company is actually now doing a screening to identify which of their staff do not necessarily need to be in the office at all, and they can work from home. The other thing that I think is going to have staying power here is how the role of renewable energy or clean energy, it's becoming very interesting, this sort of a nexus of climate change and the pandemic. And we're seeing a lot of movements in the place where you're saying, well, you know, we're going to look at a recovery. Why not do a recovery that encompasses infrastructure, for example, that looks at the role of clean energy resources, look at this whole issue of customer demand and demand side management. I think many of those areas will play a key role going forward, especially when you look at demand side management in terms of what's happening around the world. They've seen the fact that now you have more people sitting at home. That would mean that in conditions of stress on the system, you may have to implement very interesting demand response solutions. The other thing I think is going to have staying power is the impact this is going to have on how the industry deals with regulatory and policy issues, specifically as it relates to design of tariffs. I think this is an area we're already seeing in some parts of the world where they're trying to sort of see how can they redesign their regulatory systems to accommodate for these kinds of black swan events, if you may, and how does resilience play a role here? And so the issue of resilience, I think, is going to have staying power because there's going to be significant need to make significant investments in the system for resilience. And so I think those three areas, one, you know, how workforce is redesigned, the second one having to do with the issue of resilience, and then obviously the regulatory tariff design. I think those are areas that I think we will be looking at over the next 5 to 10 years, I would say.
You talked about redesigning the workforce, which I think people all over the world are certainly looking at that. One of the conversations I had or recorded on the podcast recently is about broadband and just like broad sort of, you know, broadband access. And in my mind, this is the digital divide has never been as stark as it is right now with everybody working from home. Have you been paying attention to what other countries are doing to deal with broadband access as it relates to this like reoriented workforce?
Yeah, I think fortunately, many of the countries in Europe, and of course, Australia, New Zealand, Japan, they had already put in place significant broadband infrastructure. If you take Sweden, for example, they were going 100% broadband already 3 years ago. The same with Finland. So I think in that case, many of them are ahead of the U.S. in terms of deploying broadband from a societal perspective. If you take a place like Singapore, I always say Singapore is broadband on steroids because they track and monitor everything, right? And so that's very key. I think the challenge globally when it comes to broadband, and it's beginning to show its face already, is there are some concerns about data privacy issues as it relates to what I would call digital literacy, whereas people may have access to broadband, but they may not necessarily understand, you know, how to leverage broadband in a way that doesn't create other challenges for them. I mean, if you take something as easy as, say, e-learning or e-health, for example, there are parts of many countries where the non-urban communities, dwellers, may not necessarily be able to sort of harness broadband simply because the digital literacy is not there. And so what some countries are doing now is they're trying to make sure that we're not just going to deploy broadband, we're going to also spend time educating people on how to leverage and harness broadband. And that's going to be an area where I think we'll see some regulatory changes in Europe already afoot, because that's a big issue. It's not enough to just have broadband. You have to be able to use it and use it in a way that protects your privacy as well as allows you to take advantage of the opportunities that it presents.
Yeah, no, I mean, that struggle, we're seeing that all over the place, but I appreciate the perspective there. All right, so I consider you to be EEI's resident globalist, right? You've lived all over the world, a couple continents. You travel all over the world all the time.
Yes.
But you live in the U.S. when you're not on an airplane. What are some of the policies that you're seeing implemented in the electricity space right now to kind of respond to this COVID challenge that you think U.S. policymakers should be paying attention to and learning from?
Yeah, so what has been very interesting, Brad, when it comes to some of the policies that I think will be critical for the U.S. to sort of take a look at is around the issue of investing in infrastructure. What has amazed me is the level of realization in Europe, for example, as well as in Japan and to some extent even Australia, about the need to invest in the infrastructure. Electricity infrastructure. And the way they're doing it in Europe is not just in terms of looking at the benefits of the infrastructure in terms of, you know, the normal calculus we use to return on investment or cost benefit analysis. They're taking a holistic approach to infrastructure investment. And I think in the US, where we know there's a need to invest in infrastructure, especially the grid infrastructure, more investments needed. The issue is how do you do it in a way that everyone who benefits from the grid gets to pay their fair share of using the grid, right? So one way they're dealing with it, say, for example, in the UK, where we need to, let me step back. There are two things about the international world I want to mention. One, the things we should want to learn from and the things we should avoid. So let me just say the things we should avoid. In terms of the things we should avoid is in the UK, the regulators that have been taking a very, very sort of a backward view of the world in terms of the return on investments in grid infrastructure, where they've lowered the returns to utilities or electric companies in a way that I think it's going to be harmful long term. So we should definitely avoid the worst practices from around the world when it comes to that. But in terms of the best practices, we certainly want to look at how have they been able to garner the support for investing in infrastructure across Europe, in Australia, in New Zealand, in Japan. I think the approach they've taken there is making a holistic look at multiple value streams of investing in the grid. Just one last example, during the coronavirus pandemic here, we've seen the importance of electricity. Well, imagine if you hadn't invested in a distribution system, you could have had all kinds of issues when it comes to being able to supply electricity to hospitals and other areas. So I think there's one lesson to learn is that infrastructure is key. The other lessons that I think U.S. regulators and policymakers should pay attention to is the value of electricity as perceived by the customer. And yeah, a very good place to look, for example, would be Australia and New Zealand, where they've spent a lot of time trying to get customers to be the voice about emphasizing the value of the grid. And I say this because these are countries, especially Australia, where you have high penetration of rooftop solar. But everybody realizes that you will still need the grid. And so the challenge about making sure you can keep the grid up and running, make the investments in the grid, but also ensure that there is a balanced approach to not having people access the grid, but not wanting to pay their fair share. So that approach to make sure that the grid is invested in and everyone can leverage it, but also pay their fair share, I think is something we can certainly learn from here in the U.S.
We hope that you found this to be an informative 15 minutes, and we look forward to bringing you additional expert insights about the intersection of energy policy and COVID-19. To learn more about the electric industry's response to COVID-19, visit www.eei.org. You can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts by searching for The Current and We Stand for Energy.